Buonasera, buonasera a tutti quanti gli amici di Biennale Tecnologia, buonasera anche a tutti quanti, e sono sicura che sono tantissimi, ci stanno seguendo in streaming, per cui insomma mi sento anche di voler ringraziare in particolare il Politecnico di Torino e tutti i tecnici perché stanno permettendo in questi giorni così difficili un collegamento, tutti questi collegamenti insomma, con centinaia di ospiti da tutto il mondo e buonasera soprattutto a uno degli ospiti più attesi, Mr. David Quammen, che è uno degli scrittori più importanti di non fiction, anzi come ha detto lo stesso New York Times, è uno degli scrittori più importanti, punto. È diventato, diciamo, già famosissimo, voleva fare lo scrittore, diciamo, fin da giovane, ci è riuscito pur ritrovandosi a seguire gli scienziati, diciamo, nei luoghi più strani della Terra, dall'Artico all'Equatore. E noi, tutti noi, in questo periodo, insomma, difficile di pandemia, abbiamo avuto il suo libro Spillover, ritornato bestseller dopo più di 10 anni sul comodino tutti, perché appunto Mr. Coleman più di 10 anni fa aveva già, diciamo, pur non avendo spiriti di preveggenza, aveva già detto quello che sarebbe successo col coronavirus, con questo salto di specie che sarebbe potuto proprio avvenire attraverso un pipistrello in un mercato, in un wet market cinese, e avrebbe dato il via a un'altra grande pandemia che, appunto, come lui più volte ci ha detto, non sarà, diciamo, purtroppo l'ultima. Non voglio rubare tantissimo spazio, però, appunto, c'è una cosa che io ho avuto la fortuna e l'onore di intervistare già una volta David Quammen e quindi sono contentissima di poterlo presentare qui stasera. E c'è una cosa che è davvero importantissima secondo me per tutti anche appunto gli appassionati di non fiction, a prescindere diciamo dalla loro preparazione scientifica o meno, c'è cioè la grandissima capacità che ha Mr. Quammen di riuscire a raccontare delle storie. Perché alla fine, anche quando vogliamo cercare di leggere di scienza, vogliamo cercare di leggere prima di tutto delle storie. E sono sicura che questa sera lui ci racconterà una storia che in realtà comincia tantissimi miliardi di anni fa, passa per Darwin e finisce, insomma, una figura ai più sconosciuta. Io per prima devo dire la figura di Carl Woese, microbiologo degli anni 70, non sapevo assolutamente chi fosse, confesso, ma tutta la sua storia, appunto, e la storia soprattutto di questo albero intricato, che è anche, insomma, il titolo di uno dei suoi ultimi libri pubblicato per Adelphi qui in Italia, è la storia dell'albero della vita. E sono sicura che spiegherà perché ancora una volta, partendo dai piccoli microbi, come sono appunto i batteri e gli archei, arriviamo a capire perché è così importante per noi discutere, insomma, e cercare di capire da dove arriviamo e come siamo interconnessi tutte le forme di vita che esistono, insomma, su questo pianeta, soprattutto, insomma, vista l'attualità, del virus, di questi, insomma, di questi ultimi mesi. Prego, Mr. Coleman.
Oh, grazie mille. Thank you very much, Maddalena. And thank you all. I am very, very glad and honored to be part of the Biennale. And I wish I were there in Torino with you all. But the situation is what it is. In any case, I'm very grateful for this opportunity to talk to you about my most recent book. Maddalena mentioned Spillover, my earlier book about pandemics. Tonight, I want to talk about my most recent book, L'Albero Intricato, The Tangled Tree. And Maddalena mentioned that I don't just explain science. I don't write just the history of science. I tell stories. People want to read about people. And so when I write science, I write about people who do science and tell the stories of science. Science is a human process. So to start with, I want to tell you a little bit of a story about the making of the book, The Tangled Tree, how it came to be. Spillover was published originally in the US in English in 2012. And after that, soon after that, in the spring of 2013, I was casting around for my next book project. What was I going to write about? And I happened to read something about a phenomenon that I had never heard of, a phenomenon called horizontal gene transfer. I read a few scientific articles, one or two popular things. I dug into a book and started learning about this process, horizontal gene transfer, which is the term for genes moving sideways across species boundaries, even across boundaries between one kingdom of life and another. Now, we usually think of genes moving vertically, you would say they would move downward from grandparents to parents to offspring along a lineage. Or if you were drawing the history of evolution, the history of life as a tree, as the evolutionary tree of life, then you would think of heredity, the passage of genes moving vertically upward from the trunk of the tree along lineages onto major limbs and branches. The branches diverge, and the gene movement would be along those branches, vertical. Horizontal gene transfer is very, very counterintuitive, very different from that. Genes moving sideways, so that it implies genes moving not just along limbs and branches of the tree of life, but genes crossing over from one branch into another, from one limb into another. Now, when I read about this, I thought immediately that I knew at least three reasons from what I knew of biology why it was impossible. Genes don't move sideways. One of the meanings of a species is that it's a population of individuals that can breed with one another and produce fertile offspring, but cannot breed with other kinds of creatures and produce fertile offspring. That is the basic biological definition of a species. So it's supposed to be impossible that genes would move sideways from one species into another. The more I read, the more I realized that science had discovered this was possible. They had discovered it mostly through genome sequencing. Now I'll talk a little bit about that when I get to it. But my first reaction was, this is impossible, as I said. My second reaction was, this seems to be happening. This is very important and fascinating and counterintuitive. And I would like to write my next book about it. I wonder if I could do that. I wonder if I could write a book about horizontal gene transfer. But then I saw it was so technical, so counterintuitive, in a way so abstract, that it seemed to me it would be difficult to make it a riveting human story that would be not just enlightening to people, but that would be entertaining to people, that would be enjoyable to people, to regular readers. And that's what I try and do, create books that are artful and enjoyable, as well as explaining science. I read a little farther, and I came across a character. I came across a man I had never heard of, a man named Carl Woese, W-O-E-S-E, Carl Woese. He was a little microbiologist at a university in Illinois in the U.S., the University of Illinois, in a town in the Midwest called Urbana, Illinois. And he, I learned, had been a very important man. He was dead just 6 months by the time I discovered this whole subject. He had just recently died, and I learned that he had been a very important man. As a matter of fact, now I call him the most important biologist of the 20th century that you've never heard of. I had never heard of him. I talked to my friends who are biologists, evolutionary biologists and others. Many of them had never even heard of him, Carl Woese. But if you were in the field of microbiology or molecular biology, then you had heard of Carl Woese, and indeed he was highly respected and very famous within his field. Why was he respected? Why was he famous? Well, because he had started in the 1960s an effort to discover the deepest history of life on Earth. Now, coming back to the tree of life, Charles Darwin was the first person to propose really an evolutionary tree of life, using the tree as the representation of the way the history of life on Earth has unfolded for 3.5 billion years, 3.8 billion years, maybe 4 billion years. Carl Woese was interested in trying to discern the earliest history, going back 3.5, 3.8 billion years, to the point when soon after life had begun, it began to branch into its first major limbs. And science at that point understood that there were two great limbs that represented the two great kingdoms of life on Earth. And those two great limbs were bacteria, all bacteria on the one hand, and all other creatures, animals, plants, fungi on the other. The difference between these two great kingdoms of life was that bacteria were simple cells, single-celled creatures with no complex internal anatomy. They could be viewed under a microscope and you would see a cell, and it did not have any complex internal anatomy. On the other side, the other kingdom of life, fancy name for them is eukaryotes, eukaryotes meaning the earliest complex cells. That branch of life, that limb of life, contained us humans, all other animals, all plants, all fungi, and all of those creatures are composed of complex cells that contain their genetic material encircled in a cell nucleus and also a number of other internal organs, complex internal organs within the cells. So those were the two great limbs on the tree of life when Carl Wolf came along. He wanted to understand better what had happened. So he devised a system of research. He invented it himself, modifying some things that had been done earlier. And he created a way of sequencing at least fragments of the genome, the genetic material within different kinds of creatures. Now, in the 1960s and the early 70s, this just wasn't being done. What we knew about small creatures and cellular structures came from microscopic work, looking at creatures through microscopes and through electron microscopes, and through other forms of genetic work that would allow people to infer how genomes were changing. Sequencing of the genome, sequencing the letters that make up the DNA molecules, or there's another genetic molecule, RNA, which is related to DNA. Those are the two genetic molecules, and they're each composed of four letters that repeat in different combinations through the length of the molecule. To sequence a genome is to find out exactly what is the order of those four letters as they make different patterns in this long complex molecule. So, Karl Woese had a very important idea. He would take one molecule, a universal molecule that's found in all forms of life, bacterial life and complex life, a universal molecule, and he would try and sequence the genome of that molecule in different creatures and then compare those creatures with one another to see how closely they were related and how the branches of the tree of life unfolded. So, with the help of some grad students and some postdoctoral fellows and some of his colleagues, he began this method in the 1960s into the early 1970s. There were no fancy machines for sequencing genomes in those days. So Woese invented his own methods using toxic chemicals and high voltage and explosive solvents and radioactive phosphorus in his lab in Illinois, in Urbana, Illinois, things that safety officers would not allow now. His lab could have exploded. Some of his grad students that I talked to said it's a miracle that we weren't all dead. But using these things, he found a way to extract this particular universal molecule from different forms of life and then break it into pieces and then sequence the letters in each of those pieces using, electromagnetic materials and a method called electrophoresis, which essentially meant creating a racetrack an electromagnetic racetrack for the different fragments of these molecules and letting them race one another, and then looking at the different sections that had spread out across that racetrack, and then he could discern the letters in each section. Anyway, he would create a genome for the different features that he was sequencing. And he started comparing these genomes, looking at them, didn't have fancy computers. He did this all by hand and using mathematics. And his first great discovery was that there was a kingdom of life, a kind of creature that no one had realized that it had existed. There were some single-celled creatures that looked like bacteria, that appeared as bacteria through a microscope, that had been taken as bacteria for 300 years. And using his system, he could see these are not bacteria. He walked down the hall and said to one of his colleagues, Ralph Wolf, he said, "Ralph, these things aren't even bacteria. They were more different from bacteria than they were from us. They were more closely related to animals and plants than they were to bacteria, although they were just simple cells." So he drew a third major limb on the tree of life. And this group of creatures became known as the archaea because they were thought to be the oldest form of life. Archaeology, archaic, archaea. So now, in 1977, Carl Woese announces to the world in a scientific article, there are not two kingdoms in the world of life. There are not two major limbs on the tree of life. There are three. There is this third limb coming up in the middle. And people said, "You're crazy. You're idiotic. You're wrong." Until they started checking his data, until they started repeating his method, until they started looking at the kind of evidence he was looking at. And then they realized he was right. He was on the front page of the New York Times in November of 1977. For that moment in time, that day, he was the most famous biologist in the world. And then he disappeared again, back into his laboratory to explore the implications and further applications of this method that he had discovered. So he kept using it, this method of using this universal molecule. It's got a fancy name. It's called 16S ribosomal RNA. It's in all, ribosomal RNA is in all kinds of creatures, and that's the only thing that's important. It is a molecule that's universal. So he was sequencing that and comparing it. He continued using that method, and other scientists started using that method, and they made another great discovery. First, there was the discovery of the third kingdom of life. The second discovery was horizontal gene transfer. Using this method, scientists found that genes on some branches of the tree of life couldn't have gotten there by passage down the lineages of parents to offspring. They had to come sideways. They had to have crossed boundaries from one species into another, from one lineage, from one kingdom into another. It showed up in the genome sequencing information, the data that they gathered. And now time is passing. Now it's not the 1970s, now it's the 1980s, coming into the 1990s, and some things were changing. First of all, genome sequencing had become easier and more automated, so that what it took Carl Woese years to do, using dangerous methods, toxic chemicals, radioactive phosphorus, by now, a student can do in an afternoon using an automated machine. So these machines were becoming available in the 1990s. Also, high-speed computers were becoming better and better for processing all this genomic information. And scientists started showing that this horizontal gene transfer phenomenon had been occurring throughout the history of life. And it had been very important at certain points in the shape of the history of life. Certain major transitions in evolutionary history had occurred because of horizontal gene transfer, this phenomenon that Charles Darwin never even imagined. Let me say something about this now, because I know that mutation is an important theme of the Biennale. Mutation is the slow incremental change letter by letter in a DNA genome or an RNA genome that introduces error, introduces variation into a genome as cells replicate, as reproductive cells are created, eggs and sperm, and as lineages, as creatures pass on their genome to their offspring. Mutation is slow, small, incremental change, but it produces variation in populations, and that variation is what natural selection, Darwinian natural selection, acts upon. When there's variation in a population, then there is competition for resources. There is the survival of the fittest. Variation is what allows creatures to adapt, evolve, and change through Darwinian natural selection. Mutation is the first source of variation. Recombination, the mixing of genomes when sexual cells are created, eggs and sperm, is the second form. What's the third form of variation that we now realize it's crucial in evolution? It's horizontal gene transfer. So now we know horizontal gene transfer, this phenomenon, is one of the three major sources of variation in living creatures. Mutation, recombination, horizontal gene transfer. And horizontal gene transfer is not incremental. It's not slow. It happens in big jumps, big lumps, when a package of genes moves sideways from one lineage into another. This turns out to be very important in evolutionary history. Okay, so so as time went on, more and more scientists were working in this field and discovering the significance of horizontal gene transfer. Toward the end of his life, Carl Woese went from being a radical pioneer to a somewhat conservative man. And this is very interesting. It's part of what makes his story so fascinating for me, and I hope to the readers. He had started this revolution. He had invented the methods. He had discovered the third kingdom of life, the archaea. He had redrawn the tree of life. And now other scientists were using his methods to discover more and more instances of horizontal gene transfer. And so the tree of life was becoming tangled. To draw an accurate tree of life, scientists realized, you couldn't just be drawing limbs and branches that diverged. Some of those branches were converging. A branch was flowing from one major limb into another major limb. That's horizontal gene transfer. So the whole tree of life was becoming much more complicated, much more intricato, much more tangled than it had been. And it seems from my reading of the history and of Carl Woese's writings and his personality that he became somewhat conservative about this, and he resented this a bit. He didn't deny that horizontal gene transfer had been very important during the early stages of life on Earth, but whether it continued to operate as creatures become more complex, as the tree of life grew larger and larger with more and more limbs and branches, he wasn't so sure. And he also became very skeptical of Charles Darwin. He became somewhat bitter and resentful and competitive with Charles Darwin. He started to feel that he was a more important biologist than Charles Darwin. Now, as I've said, Carl Woese was, I think, the most important biologist of the 20th century that most people have never heard of, but he was not more important than Charles Darwin. He did not refute Darwin's theory of evolution. He did not overturn Darwin's theory. He enlarged it and enriched it. How? By adding one great branch, one great limb to the tree of life, his archaea, and also by influencing other scientists with his methods to discover how tangled the tree is, how important horizontal gene transfer is, and how horizontal gene transfer is one of the three main sources of variation. Again, mutation, recombination, and horizontal gene transfer that introduces genetic variation, genetic innovation, new possibilities into lineages, into populations of living creatures. And then what happens? What happens is that Darwinian natural selection acts upon that variation and creates wondrous diversity, complexity, and adaptation. The diversity of life as we know it. So toward the end of his life, Woese was putting on the brakes. Other scientists were moving past him. And he wrote about that. And yet he was the one who had started all this. His goal, his methods, and his influence enormously shaped late 20th century, early 21st century biology, our understanding. And part of what this has done is to challenge, to overturn three categorical ideas, what we all thought were categorical truths, absolute truths. And those were the idea of a species. A species is a discrete unit with hard borders around it. And genes do not flow from one species into another. The members of a species only breed productively with one another. The second categorical was the idea of an individual. An individual. You're an individual, I'm an individual, this animal, a dog named Spot is an individual. The discreteness and absoluteness of an individual. And third, the third categorical was the idea of the tree, the evolutionary tree, as the history, the picture of the history of life on Earth. Now, what Carl Woese did and his legacy, what he did with his influence upon thinking and upon other scientists, was to challenge and to really prove that each of those categoricals is not categorical. Each of those absolutes is not absolute. A species is not absolutely separate from other species because of horizontal gene transfer. There are genes flowing across those boundaries and have flowed across those boundaries. The tree of life is not actually tree. It's tangled. It's the tree shape does not adequately represent it because of horizontal gene transfer. We have a tangled tree with limbs flowing into each other, which does not occur in living trees generally. And third, individual. The individual we now understand is not an individual, but a composite of different forms of life that have come from different sources. Even humans, even we humans, are composites. We've heard about the microbiome. We know that we have many hundreds, thousands probably, of species of bacteria living in our bodies, not causing infections, just helping us digest our food, living on us as symbionts, living in our bellies as a great ecosystem, living on our skin, living in our throats. We have an ecosystem of microbes, bacteria, fungi, viruses, and other creatures, apart from the viruses or the bacteria that cause severe infections. We have all these other creatures living in us. But it's more than that. It's not just that. It's also the fact that even our genomes, our human genomes, contain remnants of horizontal gene transfer. For instance, the human genome consists 8% of viral DNA that has been brought into us, into the animal lineage, over millions of years of evolution by retroviruses. 8% of the human genome is retroviral DNA that has come in sideways by infection, by horizontal gene transfer. 8%. We know that from sequencing of the human genome. It can be seen. You can see that 8%, it doesn't come to us throughout the long, long lineage of animal evolution. Somewhere in the course of animal evolution, as animals evolved, some animals evolved into mammals, some mammals evolved into primates, some primates evolved into humans. While all that was happening and genes were being passed vertically from parents to offspring, genes were also coming in by infection, by retroviral infection. Now, retrovirus, you've heard of retroviruses because of the AIDS pandemic. HIV is a retrovirus. Retro meaning backwards. It's backwards in the sense that it inserts its DNA into the genome of the cells that it infects, right? So when an HIV virus infects a human, it infects immune cells, and it inserts its DNA into the genome within the nucleus of the immune cells, into the genome of those immune cells, right? When that person dies, God forbid, if that person gets full-blown AIDS, these viruses replicating, bursting out of those immune cells and infecting others, then that lineage of HIV dies. It dies with the person. But if a retrovirus infects not your immune cells, but your reproductive cells, the reproductive cells of the animal, the egg cells, the sperm cells, the stem cells that create eggs and sperm, and inserts itself into the genome, then it can be passed down from parent to offspring. And that is what has happened numerous times in the history of animal evolution, so that now 8% of the human genome is this viral DNA that has come in by infection. I'm going to end by telling you how important and even beneficial some of those viral infections have been. In the midst of this pandemic, we think of viral infections as being always bad for people. You get sick, you might die, it causes disease. But sometimes the infection of a genome by a retrovirus has had beneficial effects. For instance, one gene that came from a retroviral infection and originally formed the envelope, the membrane around the viral particle, is now in the human genome, and it has evolved and adapted over a course of millions of years of primate evolution, and that gene now forms a different kind of envelope. It forms a membrane around the placenta during human pregnancy. And that membrane around the placenta, it has a fancy name that I won't bother you with, but it's formed by this viral gene. That membrane around the placenta mediates between the mother and the fetus in human pregnancy. That membrane helps to transport nutrients from the mother into the fetus, helps to transport waste products from the fetus across the membrane out to the mother so she can excrete them. And it also protects the fetus from the mother's immune system. The fetus has a different genome because it contains half of its genes from the father, and it needs protection from the mother's immune system. This membrane around the placenta serves that function. So, without viral infection, without horizontal gene transfer, human pregnancy would not be possible. We contain that. We contain multitudes. We contain DNA from other creatures that have come to us through this process that Carl Woese discovered, modified the thinking of Charles Darwin, and created a radically new view of the history of life, a tree of life that is intricately tangled. And that's the legacy of Carl Woese. And that's why my book is titled L'Albero Intricato, The Tangled Tree. So thank you for your attention.
Mr. Foreman, grazie mille. Se lei è d'accordo, potremmo, diciamo, visto che abbiamo circa un quarto d'ora, 20 minuti di tempo prima, di dover appunto salutare e chiudere il nostro streaming e lasciare, insomma, spazio a quello che ci seguirà, potremmo fare circa 5-6 domande, così si regola, perché alcune sono ovviamente, diciamo, richiederebbero delle risposte molto molto ampie. Allora, la prima cosa, quindi alcuni dei nostri ascoltatori ci chiedono: noi quindi siamo figli di questi microrganismi, noi come umani, siamo figli di questi microrganismi batterici, si chiamano archei?
Kingdom of life that Carl Woese discovered, the archaea that had never been suspected before him, probably is our deepest ancestor. It probably is the kind of cell that became the host cell when a host cell became infected with another kind of cell, a bacterial cell, one cell inside of another. And then instead of clearing that infection, or if it swallowed that bacteria, instead of digesting that, it became the first complex cell. So there is a strong possibility that the archaea provided the host for the assembling of those internal organs that I mentioned that characterize our branch of life. So the answer is yes, there's a very good chance that our deepest ancestors are the archaea, this group that we didn't even know existed before 1977.
Elemento orizzontale dei geni di cui lei ha parlato appunto in questa lezione è anche quello avvenuto, ci sono ben diverse domande su questo, è anche quello che rappresenta la presenza dei geni dell'uomo di Neanderthal nell'Homo sapiens. Quindi ci chiedono se anche quello è stato un caso di specie di trasferimento orizzontale dei geni.
That was probably the result of ordinary primate breeding, interbreeding, and the fact that the point when we thought that modern humans had speciated from Neanderthal humans, a less modern form of human, and they had separated into different populations, then they occasionally came back together. And they interbred. A male Neanderthal with a female human, or vice versa. And so those Neanderthal genes can be found. I forget the exact percentage, but some percentage of the human genome now have been identified as part of the Neanderthal lineage. It represented the fact that our speciation, our separation, had not been complete. It doesn't require horizontal gene transfer to explain that. It's a little bit more like the situation of a wolf interbreeding with a dog, right? And it's possible now still for a wolf to interbreed with a dog, and you would have a creature that was essentially half wolf and half dog. And that's our relationship with the Neanderthals.
Possiamo dire che anche un virus come appunto il SARS-CoV-2 è un virus che funziona attraverso un trasferimento genico orizzontale, cioè prendendo dei pezzettini, perdoni la volgarizzazione, dei pezzettini di DNA da una specie e portandola in un'altra.
No, and I've been asked that before because people feel an inclination to draw a connection between my two latest books, between Spillover and The Tangled Tree. The fact is that the virus that causes the COVID-19 disease, we now call it SARS-CoV-2, as you well know. I know how deep Italy's experience of this pandemic has been and continues to be. Probably everyone in Italy knows more about this pandemic than most people in the US. Horizontal gene transfer is really not an important, I would say, not an important concept for understanding what's going on with the COVID-19 pandemic. What's important to understand is that COVID-19 is a zoonotic disease, meaning it's an animal infection that has been passed into humans and has taken hold. We need to understand which animal it came from. There is a creature that was carrying the predecessor of this virus, the ancestor of this virus, probably for millions of years before it got into humans. And it's new in humans, new and terrible in humans. Somewhere there is a reservoir host, a kind of animal that has been carrying this virus for millions of years, probably. And most likely that creature is a bat, a kind of a horseshoe bat, somewhere in China, probably southern China. We need to identify that bat. We need to find the equivalent virus in that bat as closely matched to this as we can. So far, scientists have found a 96% match of genomes in one species of bat, but 96% is not all that close. It involves maybe 50 years of evolutionary divergence. The virus in one population of bats diverging from the virus in another population of bats. So we need to find exactly the population of bats in which this virus prepared itself for infecting humans. Not that it had the intention, but it evolved to the point where it just so happens to be able to infect humans and cause this terrible disease. Those are questions that need to be solved with the COVID-19 virus. They don't entail horizontal gene transfer as an important element.
Lei nel suo libro, appunto L'albero intricato, visto che alcuni degli amici della Biennale di Tecnologia chiedevano come si intitolava l'ultimo libro per Adelphi, scrive anche il fatto che un esempio di trasferimento genico orizzontale è il meccanismo della resistenza antibiotica, che è una cosa diciamo di cui ad esempio noi in Europa sentiamo parlare poco, mentre invece negli Stati Uniti si discute già molto di più, perché lei appunto descrive molto molto bene come noi in questo momento siamo concentrati e spaventati da quelli che possono essere gli effetti disastrosi del Covid, ma c'è già un'altra emergenza come ad esempio l'antibiotico resistenza che è in atto e noi come al solito arriveremo poi tardi, no? A renderci conto quando ormai il vaso di Pandora sarà scoperchiato.
That's right, that's right, and that is a very important question. Not something I mentioned in my talk, but I'm glad for the opportunity to mention it. What are the applications, what are the medical applications of Carl Woese's discovery and his legacy and the discovery of horizontal gene transfer? Well, among the most important is understanding that antibiotic-resistant bacterial strains arise not just by that old-fashioned incremental mutation that I mentioned as being one of the sources of variation. Now, it's true that if you treat a strain of bacteria, a dangerous strain of bacteria, say Staphylococcus aureus, if you treat it constantly with a particular kind of antibiotic, say penicillin, one of our earliest antibiotics, then eventually that strain of bacteria will evolve a resistance through incremental mutation to that strain, to that kind of antibiotic, and it'll be resistant to it. It'll be defended against it genetically. What is important to understand is that horizontal gene transfer allows that antibiotic resistance, the genes that give Staphylococcus aureus antibiotic resistance against penicillin, those genes can pass sideways into another form of bacteria, Streptococcus, E. coli, Salmonella, in an instant, by horizontal gene transfer. And this is something that isn't being said clearly enough in the discussion of the problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which is a problem that's killing tens of thousands of people each year in the US and many more around the world. People are saying, well, it's because we have used antibiotics too much. We've used them on our domestic livestock as well as on humans. We've used them promiscuously when we shouldn't have been using them, especially in the US, that's a problem. And they have been able to evolve this resistance. Well, that's the part of it. But what's not mentioned often enough is that that resistance can jump from one kind of bacteria into another and can circle the world quickly by horizontal gene transfer. And that's why antibiotic-resistant bacteria are such a global problem. It's because of horizontal gene transfer.
Che cosa pensa del vaccino che abbiamo visto all'inizio di questa settimana, proprio a partire dagli Stati Uniti? La Pfizer ha annunciato che l'ultima fase, insomma, delle sperimentazioni aveva dato degli esiti positivi e quindi, insomma, secondo lei possiamo essere ottimisti sulla possibilità di avere un vaccino per il Covid, come si dice, per lo più tra febbraio e marzo, almeno, insomma, per l'arrivo in Europa, forse negli Stati Uniti anche un po' prima?
Well, we can be hopeful that it's coming soon. This is very, very good news announced this week by Pfizer and its partner. I believe it's an Italian partner, the production company that Pfizer is working with, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
I can't remember. From Germany.
Germany, okay. Okay. So, but we can be... we can be hopeful about this. I don't know if it'll be ready in large quantities in February or March, but I hope so. It sounds like an effective vaccine, but we need more testing data. It would be wonderful if this vaccine and some of the other vaccines that are coming along using similar techniques or different techniques, it would be wonderful if we have them soon, by early next year. If we have a good vaccine with reliable data, I will certainly be eager to get it myself. I would certainly recommend my family get it. I would recommend everybody get it. Then, though, we have to deal with the problem of people who have been swayed by conspiracy theories and misleading information and the denial of science to be wary of vaccines in principle. We want our vaccines to be safe. It takes time. But when we have safe vaccines, then people have to understand this is the right way to go. This is the solution. This is a very important tool in how we will eventually get this pandemic under control. And we will get this pandemic under control. But we have to have good vaccines, such as probably the Pfizer vaccine. And people have to be willing to get those vaccines, to take those vaccines, to get those vaccines for their children. I hope it'll be happening by February or March.
Ma questo, secondo lei, appunto, il vaccino è una cosa che ci permetterà di dire che sconfiggeremo questa pandemia o che il Covid diventerà, il SARS-CoV-2 diventerà endemico, come è successo per altre epidemie, insomma, e virus, come è successo per la stessa influenza, no? Quindi dovremo lo sconfiggere. Cosa vuol dire sconfiggere? O forse dobbiamo entrare più in un'ottica in cui dovremo convivere col virus, anche grazie al vaccino?
Yes, defeat is the wrong word. Control, I would say. A good vaccine or vaccines of various sorts will help us to control this virus, to end the pandemic, but we will not eliminate SARS-CoV-2 from the human population. I don't think that's possible. If we did eliminate it from the human population, because it comes from wild animals, it could still come back into the human population. Remember measles. Measles used to be a very, very serious disease that killed a lot of people, including a lot of children, around the world every year. Then we got vaccines for measles in the 1950s, and people started, when I was a child, people started getting vaccinated, boom, for measles. So we've had for 60 years, we've had measles vaccines, and yet measles is still with us. It's endemic in the human population. And in a bad year, 140,000 people die of measles still. So I think that's the way we have to think about COVID-19 and the SARS-CoV-2 virus. I don't think we'll ever get rid of it. I think we can control it. we can get back to normal lives and normal economies and normal education when we control it with vaccines and with public health measures like masks and social distancing. We can control it, but now that this virus is in us, and it's in us because of things that we've done, disrupting wild ecosystems and coming in contact with wild animals, now that this virus is in us, I think it will always be in us. And I think the grandchildren of people who are concerned about this today, 30 and 40 years ago, I think those grandchildren will still be vaccinated for COVID-19.
Quindi, che cosa dobbiamo aspettarci secondo lei ora? Cioè, ora che finalmente possiamo vedere un po' di luce, pensando appunto di quantomeno per primavera dell'anno prossimo, insomma, metterci alle spalle le immagini più brutte del Covid, perché appunto, come poi lei ci ha insegnato, invece comunque ci dovremo convivere. Però se mettiamo da parte, e speriamo di farlo appunto, le immagini più terribili che soprattutto, come lei diceva, in Italia no, abbiamo purtroppo e continuiamo purtroppo ancora a vedere, che cosa dobbiamo aspettarci? Cioè, per quanto tempo possiamo stare tranquilli prima del prossimo spillover?
Well, we, as I said, we will, I believe, solve this problem. We'll solve the problem of COVID-19 and reduce it from a pandemic to an endemic disease. It'll still be serious. It'll still be dangerous, but it won't be shutting our economies and shutting our schools and killing masses of people. We will control it. We will get past this. We will come back out onto the streets. We will come back to the restaurants and the cafes and the parks and the schools. We will be together again. We will be joyful again. We will celebrate again. But we can never forget that this is not the last pandemic that will ever threaten us. Every kind of wild creature carries viruses. And animals that have some similarity to humans carry viruses that have the possibility of infecting humans. So as long as we humans, 8 billion of us, continue with our hunger, our consumption, to draw resources from the natural world at a huge rate, we will be bringing more viruses toward us. We have to think about that. We have to think about the choices that we make, what we eat, what we consume generally, how much we travel, how many children we have, if we have children. All of those choices contribute to our impact on the natural world. And that impact on the natural world is what brings new viruses toward us. Now, so we can control that. We can reduce the chance that new viruses will spill over into us through disruption. And we can also be better prepared in future to react against spillovers before they become epidemics, before they become pandemics. We have science, we have good public health. All we need to protect ourselves better against the next one is better political leadership and better political will and better community will, the willingness to do what's necessary, not just to protect ourselves and keep ourselves happy, but to protect our communities, to protect our neighbors, to protect all the different generations that are part of our lives. We can do that, but it will take will.
Perché appunto, come poi lei ci ha spiegato, siamo tutti interconnessi, no? E questo albero della vita, più che un albero, sembra una rete, quindi diciamo, se un'esperienza, se dobbiamo trarre qualche insegnamento da questa terribile esperienza, è proprio quello, insomma, di ricordarsi che non si può spostare un albero, tagliare un albero senza appunto poi andare a distruggere un ecosistema e un mondo che è pieno di. Lei una volta ha usato un'immagine bellissima, appunto, proprio penso che fosse in Spillover, no? Che quando andiamo a distruggere un albero si alza tanta di quella polvere, e tutta quella polvere, diciamo, simbolicamente è rappresentata in realtà da tutti gli organismi che si muovono, appunto, compresi i virus, e che si vanno a spostare e quindi appunto possono arrivare ad impattare, insomma, fino a poi all'essere umano, ecco. Quindi io la ringrazio ancora tantissimo, grazie appunto a tutti.
Grazie
gli amici
mille, Maddalena. Thank you very much, Maddalena, and thank you all, Diana. And thank you, Simona, for the translating. Thank you for the wonderful help. My friends in Italy, I hope to be back and to see you soon after this is over. I will be very glad for the chance to come back to Italy. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this event.
Noi l'aspettiamo a braccia aperte quando si potrà di nuovo appunto aprire le braccia per poter stringere gli altri esseri umani, appunto. Quindi grazie, anche io mi unisco ai ringraziamenti appunto per la traduzione, per il collegamento tecnico, appunto per tutto lo staff della Biennale Tecnologia e appunto speriamo di vederci presto in presenza per la prossima Biennale e appunto speriamo soprattutto di poterci ritrovare. Diciamo con un altro libro di Mr. Woman, ma insomma avendo già lasciato come un ricordo il SARS-CoV-2,
Sì, buonasera. Grazie
ecco.
mille.
Buonasera, buonasera a tutti.